Let's open our Bibles and all read together from Job chapter 1. Job chapter 1, verse 6. And we'll read to the end of chapter 1. One day the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming through the earth and going to and fro in it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Satan replied. "Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You have blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, everything he has is in your hands, but on the man himself do not lay a finger." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. One day when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were ploughing and the donkeys were grazing nearby, and the Sabians attacked and carried them off. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The fire of God fell from the sky and burnt up the sheep and the servants, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The Chaldeans formed three raiding parties and swept down on your camels and carried them off. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, "Your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the four corners of the house. It collapsed on them, and they are dead, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. Then he fell to the ground in worship and said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. Amen. Let's have a recap from last week, just so we all know where we're at and where we're up to. What have we seen so far? Well, we've only covered the first five verses, and we were told in the first five verses of a man who was upright, a man who feared God, the greatest man in all the East. He had wealth and the perfect family, and this man, of course, is called Job. We said that the writer, and we don't know who the writer is or was, I should say, the writer was building up a picture in our minds that Job was this morally excellent man. We have to have that in our minds, and that matters for the rest of the book to make sense, especially what his friends speak to him. That'll be really important to keep in our minds for later on. The book of Job, we said, is about suffering, but to say it's just about suffering is too broad a topic. Specifically, this is all about dealing with suffering as a believer or as somebody who is a holy person. The writer wants us to be clear in our minds that this trial, or trials, it's probably more accurate to say, is not because of something specific that Job has done, and this is God's way of getting him back. Recently, I was listening to a CD, and it was talking on that CD about justification by faith. And this person that was introducing the song said, if you don't understand justification by faith alone, when something bad happens, it's like a double whammy, because not only are you facing a trial, but also you're thinking, does God hate me? When actually, when we understand that we are blessed because of Jesus, we know that that's not true. So it's not a double whammy when we understand justification by faith, but that will come up later again, and I'll explain that more in future weeks. It's very easy in our passage to see two very clear sections, isn't it? And there is a very clear divide, and we read the same words which signal the beginning of the two sections. So you'll see in verse 6 and also in verse 13, it says, one day, And so that's in verse 6 and also 13, which is obviously indicating the start of a new section. In some versions, it says, now there was a day. So that, like I say, is a repeated phrase, which is obviously very clearly giving us these two sections in the passage that we've read tonight. The scene, I mean, it's really obvious, isn't it? We all, as we read that passage, as I read it out loud and you listened and followed in your Bibles, it was really obvious, wasn't it? These two different, very distinct scenes. If you were making a film, which is sometimes a good thing to imagine when you're reading the Bibles, trying to get all the different scenes, it's like it's not just a change in camera angle. This is an entirely new location. These are two very distinct things. So in verses 6 to 12, we're in the heavenly realms. In verses 13 to 22, we're in the earthly realm. In verses 6 to 12, we see spiritual things. In 13 to 22, we see physical things. In verses 6 to 12, we only know that because God has revealed it to somebody and it's been written down. Whereas verses 13 to 22, if we were there at the time, if we were in the East, if we didn't see it, we would certainly hear about it. It was something that everyone would know about because it was happening right in front of people's eyes. So they're the two different scenes that we have going on. So let's look at the first section, which is verses 6 to 12. And you can call that section whatever you want, but it's this event that's happening in heaven. We're in the heavenly realms. And in many ways, because of that, there are many things here that we don't understand because it's happening in the heavenly realms. It's really difficult for us to get our heads round. There are not many times in the Bible where we get an insight into the heavenly realms. We do in the book of Zechariah. We do in the book of Revelation. There are other places in the Bible, Isaiah. There are not many times where we get this vantage point where we are looking directly into heaven and the heavenly realms and see what's going on. But this is one of them. So what's going on here? Well, the main thing in those verses 6 to 12 is there's this debate that's going on, if you like. If you want to call it that, it's probably not the best term to use. But there's this discussion going on between God and Satan. And Satan has this accusation to bring against Job. And Satan literally means adversary, or in my footnote in my Bible, I don't know what it says in yours, but it says accuser in mine. So it's the adversary, the accuser. He's bringing his accusation against Job, but also that accusation, although it's against Job, that also is really an accusation against God as well, which we will see when we get onto it. It's worth pointing out, and I think this is worth us having in our minds again, right through the book of Job, that what we're reading in verses 6 to 12, and also in chapter 2 in the heavenly realms, Job doesn't know about this. So he's not being sent an email or a text message, or he doesn't have the book of Job to read to know what was going on. He has no clue of this scene that's happening in heaven. So we have a distinct advantage over Job because we know that this has taken place. And because this has taken place, and we know it's taken place for Job, we don't know, but we should have in our minds, perhaps this sort of thing is taking place for us. That should be something that we have in our minds as well. So let's look at the conversation. The angels and Satan appear before God, and it's interesting, isn't it, how, you know, loads of questions are opened up there. You know, why Satan sort of got access there, but perhaps it's because he has to present himself to give an account of what he's been doing to God, because God is in authority over him. And God simply asks Satan where he's been, and his response is he's been roaming through the earth and going to and fro in it. And we're probably not surprised by that, because in the book of Peter, it's 1 Peter 5:8, it says, your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. So we shouldn't be surprised that he is roaming across the world, and we read that at this point. Now we learn, of course, and there's so many little things that we could spend ages on, little things that we learn about Satan, the fact that he's limited, he can only be at one place at one time, and you know, we totally deny any thinking that God is here and Satan is alongside and there's this cosmic battle, who's going to win? God is up there and Satan is way down. He's more powerful than us, but he's, compared to God, he's a created being as well. Satan is. God created him. So therefore, he's not in any way an equal or a peer of God. We mustn't think that at all. He's not all-knowing. And again, that will come up next week. And he is answerable to God. And then God asks Satan a very interesting question. And the commentators disagree, really, why God is asking this question. And we see it in verse 8. Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. Now, I just think that's great. And last night I read that lengthy quote by Jonathan Edwards speaking on holiness, just a small extract from it. He said, "Oh, how may angels stand with pleased, delighted and charmed eyes and look with smiles of pleasure upon their lips upon that soul that is holy. How may they hover over such a hold to delight, to behold such loveliness. What a sweet calmness, what a calm ecstasy does it bring to the soul. How doth it make the soul love itself? How doth it make the pure invisible world love it? Yea, how doth God love it and delight in it?" And that's what's going on, is it? God is just delighting in Job. And he points, God points out his delight in Job. I wonder if God can say such a thing about us. And the wonder of the gospel is, of course, because of Jesus' death, yes, he can. We are blameless. We are upright in God's sight. We are his beloved children. He does delight in us. But then there is, of course, our daily walk, isn't there? And our daily growth in holiness. Does God point at us and delight in us in those areas? But Satan brings his accusation. And this is it. This is really the sentence, the verse that we really need to understand. So after God has spoken about Job, Satan replies in this way, verse 9. Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You have blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. Now, we must get to the bottom of what this accusation is all about. Do you see what he's saying? What his accusation is Job's worship of God is entirely dependent on him getting all the good stuff. Okay, that's put in like the street version or something, the paraphrase. The only reason Job is devoted, this is the accusation, the only reason Job is devoted to God is because God has given him a comfortable life. So the accusation, of course, the implied thing is, if God takes all that away, it's stated, isn't it? If God takes all that away, then Job will no longer be the picture of piety, but he will instantly become a blasphemer. Or to put it slightly differently, Job is a mercenary. He's only serving you because he gets paid for it. It's because you're making it worth his while. He knows which side his bread's buttered on, whatever you want to say to describe it. And we need to pause right there, because this is a huge question. And it's a soul-searching question. Simply, what's your reason for being a Christian? Now, I'm not talking about, you know, when we heard the gospel and how God opened up. I'm not talking about the dynamics of how you become a Christian. I'm talking about, why do you have faith in God? What is your reason for being a Christian? The other day, I was having a conversation on the telephone with somebody, and he was telling me some of his acts of kindness to other people. And he knew I was a pastor. So a bit tongue-in-cheek, he said to me, "It's actually quite good being able to talk to a pastor. Do you think because of all these good things that'll guarantee me a place up there? I mean, you must have a direct line or something, don't you? Can you put in a good word for me?" That's what this person said. And I very quickly told him that there was good news, and it's not what he has or hasn't done. It was all about believing in Jesus. Now, he was from Jewish ancestry, so he wasn't too well received. But despite my best efforts telling him that Jesus was a Jew, he wasn't entirely convinced. Anyway, back to the point. He wasn't interested in God at all. He was interested in having a nice place in heaven and a good life now. Now, here's where it gets personal. What about you and what about me? What is the motive, the reason for me and you being a Christian? Are you simply a Christian because you think that's the way to make sure you're guaranteed a good life? So I'm going to be a Christian because then when life's tough, I have this thing called prayer and God will sort my life out. What's your devotion to God like? I mean, do you only pray at bad times? Because the pagans do that, don't they? When life's going against them, they soon pray asking God to come and help. And I know it's through trials, it's through difficulties. God uses those times to help us recalibrate our lives. But if we only ever seek God when life is tough, then actually it would seem perhaps that our entire devotion to God is because we just simply want a trouble-free existence. So is that why you're a Christian? Is that why I'm a Christian? Is that why we love God? Because if we love him and serve him and do stuff for him, then he owes me a good life. And then he'll give me everything I ask for. Let me package this a little bit differently. Is God an end or is he just the means to an end? Let me use an illustration. Why do I exercise? Well, at the moment I don't, because it's winter and -9 apparently at night. But when I do exercise, I do it because I want to be healthy, not because I enjoy exercising. I mean, who enjoys exercise? What sort of a person, you know, is like that? But anyway, see, being healthy is the end. So I don't exercise is just the means to an end. So is God the end or is he just the means of getting a good life now and in the future? Do I worship him just so I get all his good stuff? I mean, we look at the parable of the prodigal son, don't we? Or sons, we should say, because the first son, he wanted all the father's stuff and didn't want him. And it would appear the second son was the same, but he was just trying to get it in a different way. He was just being a good boy, so he'd get all his dad's stuff, but actually he didn't want to be in with the party. He didn't want to be with his dad. Again, he just wanted control of his dad's things. This is a massive thing. And it might seem like, it's not a big deal. It's just something I'm making a big issue of. This is a massive deal. Imagine a marriage where one of the spouses doesn't love the other person. The only reason they're in that union is because they want the house and the money. We would all look on, wouldn't we, and say, what a terrible, tragic thing. And in fact, we've got a classic example for you ladies in Pride and Prejudice. You know, has anyone seen that with Mr. Collins? I'm giving myself away here. Mr. Collins, the vicar, you know, and this girl married, he's a bit of a dork. But this lady marries him because she just wants the big house and the easy way of life. And, you know, and she's like, you go and spend time in the garden, dear. I'll just sit in my lounge and drink tea and have friends round. See, it's funny, but it's tragic, isn't it? It's such a terrible, hypocritical thing to say that you have affections for this person when actually you don't care about them. All you care about is all their stuff. What's your love for God like? If he took everything away from you, would you throw in the towel? Would you say, "What? How can I serve a God like that? What reason do I have if he treats me like that?" That's a question we need to ponder. What's my reason for being a Christian? Is it for God or is it just for all his stuff? Anyway, the conversation ends and in verse 12, God says to Satan, "Very well then, everything he has is in your hands. But on the man himself, do not lay a finger." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. And of course, again, we'll look at this next time. Satan is limited in what he is allowed to do to Job. Next section. This is the earthly disaster. Again, call it whatever you want. This is this scene that's happening on earth in the east. This is the physical. This is what we all can see. This is what will be being reported in the local newspaper. It just changes, doesn't it? I mean, the memories of Job 1-5, even though this is happening, we don't know like how much time has passed since we've read 1-5 and we get to verse 13, but the point is he's got this perfect existence. But then after we read verse 13 to the end of the passage, it just totally changes, doesn't it? And the realities of verses 1-5 just seem ages ago. Because Satan goes out from the presence of the Lord to destroy everything that Job has. If you had to deal, I mean, can you imagine having to deal with one of these situations? It'd be a nightmare. But Job has all of them to deal with, and no sooner has one servant finished his report, the next one turns up and gives him more bad news, and it seems to be getting worse and worse. And finally, the final thing is, of course, when he gets the report about his children. Let's read it. I mean, it's so easy, isn't it, just to read this? And we know the story so well. We don't think of the emotional turmoil that must have been going on inside Job's head and his heart. Just try and picture yourself as Job. So verse 13, one day when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were ploughing and the donkeys were grazing nearby and the Sabians attacked and carried them off. They put the servants to the sword and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The fire of God fell from the sky and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The Chaldeans formed three raiding parties and swept down on your camels and carried them off. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, "Your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the four corners of the house. It collapsed on them, and they are dead. And I'm the only one who's escaped to tell you." It's horrendous, isn't it? I mean, horrendous doesn't even get close. When you look at the verses, there are two accounts which are horrendous evil committed by men. And there's also two accounts that we would class as natural disasters. So there's men who come and slaughter servants and take away the livestock, and then there is the great wind, basically a hurricane or something, and then there is the fire that's falling from the sky. What would your response be? What would you do? Well, first and foremost, you would grieve, wouldn't you? And that's exactly what we see Job doing. That's exactly what Job did in verse 20, and I assume this is cultural. At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. This was just a picture of mourning, showing everyone the distress he was in. This was a man that was in the depths of despair. You know, and we shouldn't rush over that lightly. But then the next words that we read are nothing short of a miracle. "Then he fell to the ground in worship." He fell to the ground in worship and said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. Satan was wrong. Satan was wrong. Job's devotion to God was genuine. Job's devotion was not dependent on life going well. Job's devotion was not dependent on having a load of stuff. Job praised God because God is worthy of praise. God was proved right. The liar was shown to be a liar. Now, of course, like we've said, Job didn't know what had gone on. But he had proved God right and silenced the accuser in the heavenly places. He just responded in the situation the only way he knew how. He was in massive grief, but like in verses 1 to 5, he was a man who turned away from evil, who was blameless and upright, and feared God. It's interesting. Although it was Satan that went out from the presence of the Lord to wreak all this disaster, ultimately Job says, doesn't he? The Lord has given and the Lord has taken away. He knew this wasn't outside of God's control. That's important for us to remember. Satan had to ask permission and God set the limits. And we'll look at more about that next week. And that's very important to know. Some people within Christian circles have a real problem with Job's theology, by saying God has given and God has taken away. But imagine if this was outside of God's control. Imagine if Satan didn't have any limits. Imagine there wasn't the restraining care of God. What a dreadful prospect that would be. But we'll think more about that next week and why that's good news for us in our day-to-day lives. So Job passes the first test. Now, we know there's more to come. But Job passes the first test. And actually, the New Testament builds on exactly the same themes that we see here in the book of Job. Do you remember Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, where he gets to the very end and he gives a parable about a wise and a foolish builder? And the entire point of the parable is, you'll know, the one who builds it on sand, when the storms come, it falls down. Those who build it on the rock, when the storm comes, it stands firm. And of course, there's a song that goes along with that as well. And the purpose of the parable is to say that trials reveal whether our faith is genuine, like Job's, or bogus. See, when the trials of life come, and it doesn't matter if you're a believer or an unbeliever, trials of life come. If you have genuine faith in God for who God is, yes, it'll be tough. It might be an absolute nightmare like it was for Job, but that faith will keep you through. Because God is holding you. God is with you. Your circumstances will not be able to make it disappear. But if your faith is bogus and it's based on life going well, then when the trials come, the faith will be gone. So it's well worth asking. Now, I don't know where everyone's at tonight. I know where some people are at in regards to tough situations. But if you're not in a tough situation, it is really worth asking these difficult questions now. That difficult question we had right at the start. What is your reason for being a Christian? Because if you wait until the tough times to find out the answer, then that's going to make it really, really tough. But when life is perhaps a bit easier, when life isn't quite as tough, do some soul searching. Ask the difficult question. Do I have faith in God and Him alone and worship Him for who He is? Or actually, am I just after all His things? Next week, we'll move on to Job 2. We'll look at the whole of the chapter. And then, someone was asking me how we're going to look at this. We're going to pick up the pace a little bit. Because you'll know that there's quite, if you've tried to read through the book of Job, it gets quite wearisome. And I think it's supposed to. Because I think Job is getting wearied by his friends. And I think we're supposed to get that impression that it's tough going listening to them. So we're certainly not going to look at every verse and every chapter that they speak, but we will look at the different cycles and what they have to say and how what they say is right and wrong and what Job has to say is right, and also perhaps where Job maybe doesn't quite get it right as well. Dare I say that when at the end it says that what he said was right, but he did, didn't he? Who is this that questions me, a man without knowledge? So we'll be on to chapter 2 next week. It'd be great if you could read it in advance so you know what we're looking at.